Hello, David.
E, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
It feels like forever since I've heard your voice.
I had the same experience about yours.
I know.
How did you get that photograph of you that you posted announcing this podcast? It's got you sitting on the side of the road with your hippie boots and your amazing hair. Who took that picture?
Oh, I did. I was actually trying to catch the sunrise when we went on our RV trip. I think it was, I'm getting all these national parks confused in my mind, but I believe it was Crater Lake, and we had a campground, and I got up really early because the day before I had spotted this area, and I was like, oh, the sun's gonna rise here. I know it. It's gonna be amazing. And so I got up early and I did that. And I was like, man, I wish I could take a photo of my kids here. So I was like, you know what? I don't think I've taken any photos of myself. And I kind of really was sitting there, like just looking out at the scene. And so it kind of looks like cheesy in a way, but it was kind of a photo of what I was really doing and thinking about how I should just document what I'm really doing in this beautiful area that just, you can't help but feel humbled by. So that is what I did. You have a timer. I have a timer on my camera, so I actually just put it on a stump and then just press to
Really,
go. Yeah.
it's
Yeah.
glorious. It's
Thank
really
you.
beautiful.
Thank you. Well, I guess we should say welcome to the spiritual
Involution.
involution.
Tell us,
So
Katie, what is the spiritual involution? What does that mean to you? Because I know that terms and definitions tend to morph and evolve.
still means what I think it meant for me, at least in the beginning, which is this inward look at yourself, at involution, so I can evolve and expand in my own home, in my own place, in my own soul, so that hopefully we can trickle that out externally. That's sort of how I take it. What about you?
Thank you for asking. As I endeavor to unfold or unroll or evolve, I must also involve. So I think the definition remains the same. I want to spiritually evolve, which means there must be some involution that
Yeah.
precedes evolution. So that's what we're doing. We're involving ourselves in a conversation about spirituality.
Do you think a spiritual evolution would entail everyone taking a deep involution internally for our collectiveness to then evolve?
Well, yes, and I have the firm belief that we're all sharing the same spirit or the same mind, if you will. Therefore, if one of us is doing it on some level and in some measure, everyone is doing it. So I don't know if we necessarily need, like in the physical world, there's a critical mass. I think in the spiritual world, one person who's very clear is a majority. So I think it's sufficient. Even biblical and other spiritual texts will lead us to the importance of even two people coming together are unstoppable.
I like that. I have a vision of what you're saying, and then I have a contradictory vision almost of where I see an involution of two people being a catalyst for other people to take the involution, but I have this vision of the second coming of Christ almost being a universal coming of each individual taking upon themselves this rise of consciousness that once we all do get there, it would be a whole new paradigm.
Where's there?
I think, like biologically, right? There's a time when there was just these single-celled organisms, and then they collectively came together, right? And then something evolved from that, a creature, and then the human. And it seems like perhaps what if there was another leap where we are like the single-celled organisms and we're waiting to come together to finally realize that we actually aren't divided, that we aren't separate, that we are one thing, the way you're talking about it, but conceptually, I don't know if we're, well, conceptually we might understand it actually, but I'm wondering if we need to reach that level where we take our mind out of it and we actually are it in that full, and you know, that feeling like how I was feeling when I was looking for the sunrise, that full encompassment of oneness with your surroundings, with nature, with each other. If that, like the amoebas coming together, would that, is there a leap where then the divisiveness ends?
Well, I've been thinking about, you use the word divisiveness, and that's what just woke me. Divisiveness exists inside of me. Like if I see the world as divided, then I'm going to see the world in a particular way, whether or not the world really is that way. That's the way I will see it. And I will get evidence for it. And that will be, it will be my experience as being real. Before you use the word divisive, I was listening to you and I was wondering, is there any part in me that believes there's something wrong with the world right now that has to be fixed or stopped or changed? That's my spiritual work. Not necessarily that there's a destination like the second coming or the world's going to be better when blank happens. Can I have an experience of a perfect world right now? Now, this will probably cause alarm or outrage or people to now just sort of check out of this podcast because they're like, oh yeah, he's a crazy guy or insane.
But I have a question here.
Please go on.
Could I be secure in this moment thinking it's a perfect world in the idea that evolution is coming, that we are constantly a mode of change, and in order for the change to occur, this moment is necessary and thus perfect, but not to mean that this is actually perfect. Like I listened to your sermon the other day about, I'm not going to pretend it's Pollyanna-ish. I can see the fear, I can see the divisiveness, and yet it is perfect because maybe that's what's necessary. It's needed. So that's where I'm wondering. Like I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong in this moment, but I think it's a moment that's needed for something to rise out of.
Is it needed? Like if that doesn't happen, there will be some unrequitedness?
Well, I suppose each way it goes, this is sort of where free will comes in, I think. It could go either way, and in either way, it might be perfect, right? It might be the way it's supposed to be. Personally, I think that we're in a time where we have to choose one direction or we will cease to be as a species soon, like within a few hundred years. So in my mind, my personal will would be for us to learn to not do that, to be in a harmonious, more of a harmonious situation with our planet, with each other. That's my free will. And I feel like being here as a soul in this body can affect that direction. Just like we were talking about two people, it only takes two people being clear in that to make a change. So there's this dichotomy that I feel between sitting here and just being okay with what is, and also sitting here being okay with what is while also moving it in a direction that I think would be more peaceful, which to me is our truest nature. Those two things rub for me a little bit while I see beauty in each of them, if that, but there's always paradox, right? We're always talking about how there's always paradox.
I'm finding myself right now fully alive because whenever I'm engaged in an exploration with you, I actually have the freedom to really explore ideas. It's one of the gifts that is Katie Burke. You really do create an environment where I can explore, where I don't have to defend or protect or prove. So I have the experience when you ask a question that you're really asking the question, which causes me to really look. Now, in the world as I've assessed it, now that's not necessarily the world that is, it's just my view. There are a lot of people who are living lives in their heads and not living their life in their life. They're literally living their life in their head. It's really not showing up in their life. And they're not necessarily present to what is. They're constantly outraged about what isn't or what they think is going to be, but they're not really.
Is there a difference between, sorry, is there a difference between living in your head and living in your heart?
That could probably, we could have a conversation about that. And I would say that there's a third option. There's living in my head, which means in ideation, in concepts, thoughts, as opposed to living in my life, which is in my body, in the food that's in front of me, in this cup of coffee, in the conversation I'm having with you. So there's the life in my head, which is a life of imagination, or the life of reality.
And so where I'm trying to figure out is I like the life of reality, and I like the life in my head sometimes. I do like the power to turn it off. I don't like when it's going without me saying to go. And then I like the life of right now, but it seems void of emotion. And sometimes I'm in a spot feeling life, like I'm in life and I'm having a visceral heart feeling. And sometimes that's telling me there's a pain here. I want to help it. Or sometimes it's joy, or sometimes is that, what is that in the whole organization of where to be? Is that something to move you? Or is that something to sit in? Is that something to be aware of?
I don't know. While you were talking, I was thinking about Tess. Really, Tess, your daughter. For those of you who don't know, Tess is one of Katie's children. And Tess is at that age where, imagine any child who's a toddler, or between toddler and kindergarten, let's say, and that they have the ability to cause adults to be entranced. A cheerful child has the power to alter everything. I've noticed that if I stood in front of a toddler and made a herky-jerky movement with a smile on my face, like I'm playing this mirror game, they would immediately mirror it back with a smile on their face. They just jump right into the game. Is that mostly true, Katie, or not?
Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. So I'm not sure if this has anything to do with what you wanted to talk about, but it's what's present for me right now, is being present to life as a game right now requires me to actually be present for life right now without the mental gymnastics of figuring out, is this a good thing, a bad thing? Do I have time for this? What a waste of time. Don't they realize the world is burning and there's a civil rights unrest and there's so much going on in my head that is not based on reality.
Right. That resonates because that also allows you to feel in the moment.
So let's go back to, is that your heart? Mm-hmm. Is that what you meant by heart?
Yeah.
Yeah. The picture of you, that picture I saw on Facebook, is indicative of what I think I hear you say. Because when I look at the picture, that woman was up to something. She was in life. Even if what she was thinking about is the timing happening, has the timer clicked, has the picture shot, when's the sun coming up? I wish my kids were here. But she was fully present on the side of that road in that state park just before the sun came up. Many of us are not. We're on this big countdown for the end of the world, for elections in November, whichever way people view it. We're on this, like something terrible is about to happen. And when we continue this idea that something terrible is about to happen, we should not be surprised when something terrible happens. I was just reading, I have to dig it out. I don't know from where it came. Joel Osteen, he would be on the right of middle, let's say, a Christian on the more conservative, let's say, viewpoint. And I like, I often read stuff that he posts just because there's some timeless and eternal spiritual wisdom that's presented in a very useful kind of form. Now, in particular, I'm pointing to quote that I saw on his Facebook page, and it was about scripture will tell us that we will eat the fruit of our words.
You know, that's so interesting that you just said that, because at night I have been reading to Tess and Noah Greek mythology.
Yes.
And I had each chapter is about a person. It starts with Gaia, Mother Nature. Then it goes to Uranus, Father of Heaven, who they married. And then Cronus, Zeus, and Hestia. And I just read Hestia, and I was like, wow, I am Hestia. I feel Hestia so much. Uh-huh. But I don't know who, if you recall much about Greek philosophy or mythology, but what's interesting and what you just said just totally triggered it is that there's these parables, right? And for example, Uranus became so fearful that his children were going to overcome him that they were trapped inside Gaia. He kept them in there. He's like, you cannot get out and attack me. And so his own fear produced the outcome of Cronus coming out and harming Uranus. Uh-huh. Then Cronus became the father to Rhea, and Cronus himself became fearful of the same thing that his father was that caused that retaliation. So uh-huh. the fear produced him to eat his children. He literally ate his children until Rhea fooled him and gave him a stone and let Zeus live. Then Zeus comes back and he makes Cronus throw up all his children who become the Olympians to fight the Titans. Hestia was one of the sisters that was in Cronus's belly. And she has this part in the book where she's describing her life in the belly of Cronus, darkness, and she's rubbing against her brothers and sisters, not really knowing who they are, but somehow feeling this vague connection to them of love, but yet yearning for something clearer, something more sustainable, something it was like a lack she couldn't define, but it was there. And then she came out, you know, she was hurled out of Cronus's mouth, and Zeus was there and telling her all of a sudden that you guys have to fight me now against the Titans. And she was spawned into this world of war, which she didn't want. And she's like, I don't want this. This is not what I was yearning for in the darkness of my father's belly. And she isolated herself from it all. She's like, I'm not going to be part of it. I'm not going to be part of you, Zeus. I'm not going to be part of the Titans or the Olympians. And she went inward and became the goddess of hearth, which is fire, warmth in the home. And so everybody had like an altar for her inside the home that was the light, that was the love. And she just didn't partake in any side. And I was like, that's so awesome. So I'm really enjoying Greek mythology, and I'm a fan of Hestia, but it reminded me of your quote. Did that make sense?
So we will eat the fruit of our words. It's from Isaiah 3.
Right.
Sometimes it's interpreted, eat the fruit of our doing or the fruit of our labor, but the fruit of our words, what is it we're saying? So I'm really grateful to have this time with you, Katie, so I can on purpose stop and ask myself, what have I been saying about the world? I need to be really careful.
So. Yeah. And what do you, that's an iPhone. With that in mind, what are you saying in the world? I get how it can produce the outcome that you don't want, right? You're eating, the fear is causing the fear. But then do you deny a reality that's existing and become a fake Pollyanna to reverse and say things?
Let's be real about this. What is reality? So much of what I think is reality really isn't reality. It's my view.
Is it?
Is it hot or is it cold? No, it's a particular degree.
Yeah. So, but I mean,
if you look, I saw a series of maps. I was at a friend's house yesterday, and in their bathroom was the most remarkable book. And I had to take it out of the bathroom, else I would have been in there too long. And this book was nothing but stories about the world viewed through maps. So how big is Africa in reality? And then it showed different cutouts of different maps that fit into it. And you suddenly see, oh my God, North America, South America, most of Europe fits into the size of Africa. And one of them showed the United States and the world who believes that global warming is worrisome. And it showed each state and country by percentage of people who believed that it was worrisome. And California was red hot. Like it literally was the reddest. It was the reddest outline on the map, which showed that the conversation is very alive in California. Now, I'm just using that as an example. Let me put aside global warming. Let's put aside climate change for just a moment. The news that we get here in the coastal areas, and even where you're living is still somewhat coastal, is quite distinct from that which might be happening in the heartland or elsewhere in the world. The view that we have about the future of the world may not be reality as I see it. Remember, Katie, remember that Mauricio said he never, even though he grew up in a developing country, and he grew up where the poverty rate is astronomical, he never met anyone who was miserable until he moved to the United States. That is very telling. So there are people who are living in abject poverty who might actually have the experience of life being valuable, peaceful, enjoyable, fulfilling. And there are people who live in highly sanitized, highly industrialized, highly medicinized environments who may be miserable, who say, you don't know the facts, but I'm not so sure. What are the facts?
I don't even know, for me, it's the facts as much as dialogue I'm having with people, seeing actual violence on news feeds, or, I mean, maybe that is totally fake, but even, you know, I think there's the reality of what your life is. And I think that is very important. And then I think there's also a reality of what the world is feeling as a whole. And that could be fabricated too, right? But it's still, it's not that it's not there. And it could be very well be that some people in poverty are happy and don't feel miserable. Yet I still feel poverty shouldn't exist. Like the fact that somebody has to struggle for food and is happy still bothers me. I'm glad you're happy. That's really actually something that I should take to heart and realize that I have no reason not to be happy if you can be happy, but I don't like the fact that you're struggling for food, or I don't like the fact that you feel isolated, even if your isolation is a product of something in your head that might be based on a untruth. The fact is it's remaining there, right? And so I don't know. I think I'm struggling. I always feel like I'm struggling with that idea of seeing the world and then also seeing my own world. I mean, we've talked about this before, but again, going back to the idea that it doesn't mean that it's not perfect, that there's something wrong with it, but I can still see the problem. It's like we don't have words. I don't, even saying the word problem means to you probably that there's something imperfect, but I'm seeing it as a disconnect or something that I don't like and I want to help.
People right now who are calling for defunding the police or who have actually demonized police forces in the United States will show you videos and case histories of abominational acts, okay? And they will present that to you that it is a systemic problem. And they will cause you, and when I say you, I mean they will cause a person to be alarmed and worried that we must have a revamping or a revisiting. At the very least, we need to revisit the institution of policing. And they will tell you that that's based on facts. The United States, as I know it, has more than 300 million people in it. And case after case after case, there could be a really lengthy list. But when you measure that compared to the population and the constant flux of people in and out of the United States, those numbers are going to be minuscule. But I'm going somewhere with this. I remember when the Twin Towers fell. Our brothers and sisters on the right and our brothers and sisters that call themselves conservative began to have the conversation about fear and protection and arming ourselves. Our sisters and brothers on the left and the liberal wings said, do not judge an entire group of people based upon the abominations of a few. I remember very clearly the left and the liberal were saying, do not judge people in a particular religion or from a particular region based upon the actions, the abominations of a few. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But the world I see now is that we are judging all of our brothers and sisters who wear blue based upon the abominations of some. I find that to be ironic and a bit worrisome.
I agree. I'm trying to now combine that with our thoughts before.
let me see if I can close the loop. The point being that what I think may be factual really may be based on a cumulative gathering of a particular viewpoint and not necessarily based upon, I can actually view the world as being worrisome and in trouble, but I have to slow down because biologically my heart and my soul is telling me that the information that is getting my attention right now is skewed in a particular way. It's skewed to alarm me and to scare me.
Yeah, you know, I've been struggling.
And Katie, if that's true, there's got to be a counter to it. That means there must be an entire world that is also skewed to cause me to be peaceful and joyful.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if those are necessary opposing views. I'm struggling because it's so complicated, and I like numbers when I'm lost. I figure, even though I'm horrible at math, I like looking at like numbers because it takes away the emotion for a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And I see the numbers in everything you say with the police stuff. Like, I get it. The numbers, they take away a bit of the emotion, but yet on an emotional level, it's a perspective seen by different people in different ways based on where they lived, based on their skin color, based on these views that I do agree are being manipulated by the media, and thus we are getting a different umbrella. And I do wish that we could talk about it all in a way that we won't be judged. And that is a struggle I feel I'm struggling with, is this idea of, can we look at all parts of this puzzle? And if we overstep or if we are wrong, do not take it as me being an evil person or like that. It's like how we're talking right now. It's like a log. And I don't know. I'm still struggling on where it all fits because some of it makes so much logical sense. And then some of it makes historical sense, and some of it makes emotional sense for me. And there has to be an intersection somewhere. But I worry that the people that are in the super emotional camp are not seeing the factual camp sometimes because it's going against the emotion. But I also think the factual side doesn't see the emotion and devalues that. So it's very, very tricky. But I think that the end of this, though, we have to go through it together. We have to open our dialogue, and we have to be okay with people being wrong, people stumbling, people falling. And the counter cannot be attack on your moral character. Because right now, if you question what you're questioning, you can be called a racist or ignorant at best. And that shuts down the conversation, right? And I wish that wasn't there. I wish we could get through to a place where we see clarity on these topics without the go-to response being an attack on your character as a person who is just questioning the narrative. And that, you know, brings me back to the topic that I wanted to initially talk about, which we probably won't today because we're already at a half hour. But I did want to talk about our fixation with identity, which I think plays a big role into this skewed nature of our attachment to being something particularly our attachments to being something that's immutable, something we're born with. Like I get attachments to, you know, I get attachments to the Center for Spiritual Living. I chose to attach myself to these people because I'm in alignment with their belief system on the world. But me being a female, me being white, me being heterosexual, me being any of those things are just kind of a product of me being born into this world. And to me, I don't like that identity politics. Like even somebody the other day said, oh, I wish it would just be a young female president. And I'm like, no, I don't, I would never want to become something because based on these immutable facts, I want to, you know, I want us to somehow move beyond that. Yet I know the historical context is holding us back. But to me, it's all based on a fallacy, and the root of it is false. Like there is no weight in these things that should be used in the way it's being used right now. So that's, I mean, that's a whole nother podcast, probably. Yes.
It seems that you're the one who's putting weight to it.
Well, I'm putting weight against the narrative that it has weight right now. The narrative, right?
from my view, life is simply it's simply experiential. So the reason why I might be in physical form is so that I can experience what I cannot experience in intellectual or head form or in the ethers. So I must be down in the physicality in order to experience hot and cold, sharp, pain, joy. Those things are contrast. So life is all about contrast. And when I hear people who identify as gay, straight, black, white, brown, male, female, hetero, homo, as you wrote in your Facebook posting. I don't see them as either desirable or undesirable, that there's anything good or bad or wrong about it. It's just one particular way of viewing this thing about physicality and contrast.
I agree. I don't see anything innate in those qualities. But what I do see is that we've constructed something from our human mind to put qualities into them of which we live by. So we are constructing basically a wobbly house based on a foundation that has no inherent truth. And then we're fighting about it. We are rioting. We're yelling at police. We are up in arms. And then we want to counter it through something called anti-racism, which uses the opposite, but it's still attached to racial identity. And yep, that is where I see the problem in that we're using the same shady foundation that built up actual racism to then build up anti-racism. And if it has a faulty foundation, which to me it does, because I truly don't believe there is anything inherent in all of those immutable qualities, how do we use the same tool that built up the hatred to then take down the hatred? It doesn't make sense to me. And I think it limits our ability to express. If I have to act a certain way because I'm part of the female group, if I'm part of the womanhood, do I necessarily have to wear that pussy hat and go out and protest? Do I have to align myself with this group of what it means to be a good female? And if I don't, am I kicked out of that group? Am I stifled as an individual now because I am no longer choosing to be the group that I guess I am? And that goes for all of these immutable qualities, right? And I think there's a fundamental flaw here that's causing a lot of this trouble.
Go on.
And that's what I'm seeing. And that's why I'm speaking out against it. It's not, and in a way I am using the weight of our qualities because I want to highlight the flaw in it. And until somebody does sort of question these things, and these things are hard to question because they're not popular right now. Like they're
not, but that's not true. That's not true.
To question out loud.
That's not true.
No. Okay.
No, they're very popular, but they're not popular with the people who currently have the bullhorn.
Right.
So you have to go looking for it, but you will find that there's a silent majority that's talking about the normality of life as it is. And that's partially why I'm rather peaceful at this point, because I do have the awareness that most of our media, most of the broadcast is coming from a particular bend. But there's another side to the bend that is quite peaceful and contented. Do you know the social experimentation of, you know, we've talked about everybody agrees. I mean, almost everybody, unless you're just insane, agrees with the importance, no, with the mandate of equality of opportunity for all beings. However, equality of outcome, egalitarian of outcome, is not necessarily the best way to go, because if everybody was going to get guaranteed the same thing, then there would be no reason to strive. We would live in a world of gray. There would be no creativity, no newness. Now, there are, if you look at the Scandinavian countries, for example, I don't remember which one of the countries, so forgive me for my ignorance there, but they have mandated such that as men and women became more guaranteed equality of outcome, male and female behaviors became more distinct. So as the equality of outcome became a mandate, where men and women have the same jobs, same amount of money, same, I realize what I just said could create trouble. Let me erase that. As there is forced and mandated push for guaranteed outcome, the natural differences between men and women in those countries began to be more distinct and more divided. It's fascinating. And by the way, the proof is there and the studies are in. This is not an argument. This is measurable. So as you try to force an outcome, people's natural behaviors will cause them to be drawn more and more toward people who look like them, act like them, and speak like them.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if what I just said made any sense, but I'll send you the link to that stuff. Yes, it is really fascinating.
I keep wanting to simplify everything, you know, like it gets so convoluted and complicated. And in the end, it's like I'm fighting for individuality under the premise that we fully as individuals need to express in the most authentic way possible for us to be as a collective healthier. So the individual plays an important role in the collective health. So it seems almost contradictory that I always talk about oneness and we are one, and we are, but we are one in the sense that we have to lift up each other's individualness. And group identity to me gets in the way of that blossoming. And I want to figure out how, and maybe this is the spiritual, you know, part of the involution where Hestia went inside to create her own flame, her own home, is to recognize within your own self who you truly are beyond these group identity labels, because they're holding you back from a spiritual blossoming that I think is necessary and needed for a harmonious collective world to work. And I do want everybody to have equal opportunity. And I don't think, like you're saying, anything forced is just not going to work. Nature itself doesn't have equal outcomes of things. It's just not how it works. It's messier than that. But if we can hold in our hearts, in our love, in our heart space, the expression of how others want to express, and that could be however you want to express, that's your individual divine nature coming through. And it has nothing to do with your race. It has nothing to do with your sexuality. It has nothing to do with any of those things. It's deeper than that. And we're missing that. And we're fighting all this stuff on the basis of these superficial fallacies. And I think that's where I would like us to get. It's like we're reducing everything into this box. And I don't want the box to exist.
You know, while you were speaking, I was realizing if there's anything that unsettles me at this stage more than anything, which is my call to personal action, personal exploration and practice, is that in much of the narrative that's the headlines right now, there is a yelling and a screaming of ungratitude. There are people who are screaming, the world is a place for which we should not be grateful. And that's probably what could harm me the most is if I buy into that narrative. Mm. And that's when, and people may have a reason to be broadcasting that and they may not, but what's occurring for me is I need to slow down and do my own work so that I can be grateful for the world exactly as it is right now. And that's where newness will be born.
I like that.
Me too.
And one more. Can I add one more thing?
Yes, please do. Okay, you should have the last word.
because I want to bring it back to Tess. I wanted to tell a very quick story, which gives light to this inherent divine nature that we all have that I think we should all strive to connect to and forget about the labels. Have you ever had a moment where you just look into someone's eyes? No words are spoken, but it's like you're diving into each other's souls.
Yes.
I had that with Tess. I was just looking at her and I was thinking, you know, there was no real words. It was just like, I love this human so much. Like I can see into her little heart and it's just, oh, it's just so beautiful. And I didn't know that she would pick up on it, but she looked back at me, you know, we're having that connection. She's like, Mom, I can tell you see love in me. And I was like, oh,
wow.
Yes. I see love in you. And like, that's it. Like, that's just, if I could wrap everything up in a tiny little nut and make everybody in the world see it, that is it. Like, that is us. That's all of us have this connection. And I don't want us to view each other as the other, as evil, as less than. Like, we are like, so I just like want to shake everybody and tell them this and make them feel it. So anyway, I'll leave you with that. I just thought I was really moved that she could pick up on that. And it was there was no verbal cues. It was just this deep dive eye contact. And I thought,
wow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I love you. And thank you for the talk.
I can tell. And I love you too.
Love you. Tell hi, Mauricio hi for me. And
back to
we'll
John
talk soon.
And okay. Noah and Tess.
Yes. All right.
Bye.
Bye.